My name is Joel Muggy. This is the third in the series of U.S. Foreign Policy at the Crossroads, entitled Central America, War Against the Poor. Should probably call it more something like, how much can you squeeze about Central America into an hour? Because it's sort of hopeless to say very much in this short of time. But I'll try to do that. For those of you that haven't been at the other sessions, what I'm trying to do this week is take a look at three major areas of the world that are involved in political and economic and social crisis: the Middle East, the Philippines, and Central America. And this is the third. And pay some attention to the history and the current situation, but then also look at the role of U.S. foreign policy in the region. And then on Saturday morning, I'll try to tie some of it together in terms of some of the themes that run through all of the areas. I should say a word about the Center for Global Education, because it's relevant to what we're doing here. And I think the three areas I'm discussing this week, this is the area with which I am personally most familiar. I think I've probably been to Central America 30 times in the last 6 years, and in all of the countries in the region, and talked with people representing a spectrum that just about every point of view you can imagine. The Center for Global Education has coordinated in the neighborhood of 150 tours to Central America during that time, again to all the countries in the region. And what we do is basically coordinate educational tours for church and community groups from around the country to places in the world where our role as the U.S. is a critical dimension of the situation, and particularly where we have an opportunity to touch base with Christians in that part of the world and listen to their perspective on the world. For those of you that are interested in the center or any of the trips we do, I have some brochures on the center and a list of upcoming trips through about January of the coming year, and you're welcome to pick those up afterwards. Tonight we're going to focus on Central America, again try to give a brief historical overview of the situation, try to look at what the situation is today in each of the countries of the region. I won't be referring to the map much, but it's there for you to kind of get an idea of the basic relationship of the countries to each other, some demographic figures. Just to set it in context for you, Mexico is here. Harlingen, Texas is up there. And Panama is down here. Okay? And you can see the relationship of the countries to each other there, and what countries border on what. Notice that El Salvador does not border on Nicaragua. They're across the bay from each other, but a little piece of Honduras intercepts those, and you can see the others pretty clearly. Now, I'm going to close the discussion talking about U.S. foreign policy, but I want to begin with a word or two about policy also, because it really sets the stage for looking at the historical overview. U.S. policy in Central America is based on a series of assumptions about opposition revolutionary movements. What we're talking about in Central America is revolution. And in this country, in our policy circles, we have a series of assumptions about revolutions. Number one, that they're Marxist. Number two, that U.S. economic interests would suffer if they were to come to power. Number three, that they would align themselves with the Soviet Union if they were to come to power. And number four, that American security would be endangered if these revolutions were to come to power. Most specifically, many maintain within our policy-making circles that the cause of revolution is communist intervention from outside, in the case of Central America, from Cuba and the Soviet Union. And a victory for revolutions means communism at our doorstep or in our backyard, or whatever other phrase we want to use. And that phrase in itself tells us something about the assumptions of policymakers, that in some respects this area is ours to determine the level of the policy. We refer to it in that way all the time. Now, it's my belief that if we are going to understand at all what is happening in Central America, we have to begin by fundamentally questioning that assumption about the nature of revolution in Central America. Now, it's not so unusual for us to do that, because most Western European governments, Mexico, most other Latin American governments, do not share our assumptions about the cause of revolution in Central America. Several have even recognized the revolutionary movements in, for example, in El Salvador, the revolutionary movement that's seeking to change the governing structure in El Salvador, have recognized those forces as legitimate political movements. We have not, of course, but many other countries in the world have. Others have made peace proposals for the region that have generally been rebuffed by the United States. Their positions or their understanding are based on a different understanding of the origins of the crisis and a different understanding of the historical events that have led up to the present crisis. More specifically, they understand the roots of revolution, the real roots of revolution, to lie in the social and economic and political structures in which the countries of the region find themselves, and which the region of the whole, as a whole, finds itself. So that it's the social and economic and political situation that's really the cause of revolution, not some sort of intervention from outside. So for us to question those assumptions is not exactly abnormal when we look at the whole world scene and how other nations view what's happening there. Now, so if I'm going to make the claim, as I do, that really we've got to begin to look at indigenous roots of revolution in Central America and not as some sort of boogeyman from outside, then what are those social and economic issues that have to be addressed? If we were going to understand this really, we should look back over at least the last 500 years and have a course in history about Central America in terms of what has happened in the region. And there are many events that we'd have to be considered as in order to really understand that. Now, we can't do that tonight, obviously, but I would like to just mention two or three events that I think would be very important for us to understand more deeply. One would be the colonization of the region by the Spanish and the British in the 16th century, and the virtual enslavement of the indigenous people of the region, if not slaughter, because many were wiped out by disease, and the rest were basically enslaved by the colonizers, and the kind of beginning of this situation of dependency that kind of colonial history creates. The colonial legacy that's a part of so many countries in the world, but nowhere I think stronger than in Central America, where there's that really history of enslavement of the indigenous peoples of the region. Then in the 19th century, we'd have to understand the coffee boom that hit Central America and the way in which that began to lead to the control of power and wealth by small oligarchies in each of the countries of the region. That centralization and concentration of wealth and power in the hands of a relatively few number of people, while the majority of people, the lives of majority of people became even more desperate during that period. We'd have to understand all of the dynamics of that. Then we would really have to understand many of the U.S. military interventions in the region, including and especially, and it's only one of many, the Marine occupation of Nicaragua from about 1913 to 1933. The U.S. Marines were the occupying power in Nicaragua. They ran Nicaragua for 20 years in its very recent history. And to understand what it means for a country to have that kind of an occupying force by a foreign power at a very recent time in its history. I mean, one of the things it means, for example, just culturally for Nicaragua, the national sport in most countries in Latin America is soccer. One exception to that is Nicaragua. Guess what the national sport of Nicaragua is?
Baseball,
right? And Nicaragua is just desperately trying to put together a team for, I think baseball is an exhibition sport in the Olympics or something like that. It's not a, and they've been trying to put together a team and they can't afford it and all that sort of thing. But anyway, baseball is the national sport. There are periodic shortages of electricity now in Nicaragua, but they just put huge new lights in their central stadium in Managua so that when there's a baseball game, the stadium practically lights up the whole city. There's not enough lights in the rest of the city, but the stadium's lit. So we'd have to understand those interventions. We really have to understand the importance and the meaning of those. Another one that's very important is we'd have to understand the overthrow of the Guatemalan government in 1954, in which now, according to Senate testimony, I mean, there's not much doubt about it, the CIA directly involved in overthrowing a democratically elected government in Guatemala in 1954. That's now a matter of public record. What that means to people of Central America in terms of their understanding when we say we won't intervene, the record shows otherwise. And the people of Central America recognize very well that the United States will intervene directly if necessary. Also, as a kind of an aside here, though it's not a Central America event, the overthrow of Salvador Allende in Chile in 1973, in which again, the record, public record now shows very clearly the U.S. was very much involved, the CIA involved. That too is very, Central Americans are very aware of that reality, and it affects their thinking about everything. Now, obviously, we can't cover those 500 years in any in our session tonight, but I would like, well, let me add one, I want to make one more comment, just to read you a quote that gives you an idea of the kind of mentality that was involved in the U.S. involvement in the region. This is from Major General Smedley Butler, who was a key figure in the U.S. Marine Corps in the early part of the century. And he said, "Thus I helped make Mexico and especially Tampico safe for American oil interests in 1914. I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for the National City Bank boys to collect revenues in. I helped purify Nicaragua for the International Banking House of Brown Brothers in 1909 to 1912. I brought light to the Dominican Republic for American sugar interests in 1916. I helped make Honduras right for American fruit companies in 1903. In China in 1927, I helped to see to it that Standard Oil went its way unmolested." That was Smedley Butler's role in that early part of the century. I want to focus more on the last 25 years with a bit more detail than I have on the last 500, and see what are some of the dynamics that have been working in Central America during these last 25 years. I think most of us are aware of the extremes of wealth and poverty that exist in Latin America in general. I mean, we're aware of that. If you've been on a trip to Acapulco, if you go off the main street, you can see very clearly that the tremendous poverty. I think what we're less aware of is the depth of that poverty. I think there's very little in the experience of any of us here. Just the fact that we could afford to come to Holden Village means that very few of us have anything in our experience that can help us understand the depth of that poverty. We simply don't have anything in our experience to help teach us about that. To understand what it means, for example, that more than 50% of the people of Mexico live in homes with dirt floors. I mean, how many of us know what it means to do that? Not to just be in a tent somewhere, but to have no choice about being raised in a home with a dirt floor. So this depth of poverty in Central America is a very important dynamic in what has happened in the region. Now, many policymakers, and particularly State Department officials, say, you know, that poverty is really not the problem in Central America, because after all, there was tremendous economic growth in Central America in the 60s and the 70s. And in fact, the economic growth rate was around 6% during that time. But what is not mentioned is that most people did not share in the growth. Large landowners and industrialists increased their land holdings and their share of the profits, while lands devoted to subsistence agriculture diminished, could not keep pace with the population, and wages and that sort of thing steadily diminished. This happened at a time, the 60s and 70s, when you remember a very important program that was to bring great development to Latin America. Who remembers what it was? Well, no, that was a little bit later. That was part of the plan, but there was a Peace Corps was only one part of a very important plan for Latin America.
OAS.
John Kennedy's Alliance for Progress. Yeah, OAS was, no, that's the Pan Latin American group. John Kennedy's Alliance for Progress was a program for, of development for Latin America. And if you remember, the, one of the impetuses for the Alliance for Progress was the Cuban Revolution in 1959. Not the only impetus, but one of the thoughts was here was a country in desperate poverty. A revolution took place in which with a more Marxist-oriented government, we cannot let that happen again. And so we need to help develop the rest of Latin America. So at least we take the lid off the pressure cooker a little bit. The Alliance for Progress did, in fact, create a sharp increase in industrialization throughout Latin America. There was a sharp increase in capital-intensive production of consumer goods. There was a rapid increase in the gross national products of the region, so you get those growth rates that were really tremendous from looking at it from the outside. And there was a small increase in middle-class employment, as you can imagine, with that kind of development. But what we also saw was, and we didn't maybe see it as much until later and looking back on the situation, was a sharp decrease in employment among poor and working class groups, and therefore a steady rise in national unemployment. The unemployment rates during that period as a whole in the countries grew. And there was increased inequality because of a shift of wealth and power, of income and wealth away from working class groups into middle class sectors and above. So what economic development really meant for Latin America, for Central America particularly during the 60s and 70s, was a rise in consumer prices. It's a myth if you think that it doesn't cost people much to live in Central America. We had a period in Nicaragua last spring when we were paying $3 for a photocopy. I mean, it was really out of whack during that time. But in fact, the cost of basic goods can be many times as high as it is here. And of course, real wages are much, much lower. And so during the Alliance for Progress, we saw a decline in real wages. Until today, sugar workers in Guatemala working 12 hours a day make only perhaps no more than $2 a day for what's considered one of the most difficult jobs in the world. And we saw a concentration of wealth in fewer hands and an overall increase in unemployment. The bottom line is that the kind of development that took place during the 60s and 70s in Central America did not improve the lot of most people, but in fact, many suffered a decline in their already poor standard of living. It went down. And all one has to do is look at the statistics today in the region to see that, in fact, they're worse than they were 25 or 30 years ago. In El Salvador, 2% of the population still controls 60% of the land in El Salvador. That's after a so-called land reform that we've been involved with. In 1975, these figures are, and it hasn't changed much yet, 58% of the population earned less than $10 per month in El Salvador. 70% of the children under the age of 5 in El Salvador are malnourished. 70%. Now imagine you looking around at all the kids here this week, and that 7 out of 10 of those kids showed signs, at least beginning signs of malnutrition. That's what it's like to live in El Salvador. And 45% of the population of El Salvador cannot read and write. The statistics in Guatemala, for example, are even more devastating. 2% of the population controls 72% of the wealth. 75% of the children under the age of 5 are malnourished. Illiteracy rates are even higher. Some say in the 65 to 70 range. What do we have here? 56% in Guatemala. So that's the kind of situation we see these countries in today. It's a situation of deep and desperate poverty. But poverty alone doesn't lead to revolution. I mean, that's not the only dynamic. People can be poor, but that doesn't mean they're going to lead to revolution. Another dynamic at work is the awakening of the poor to their situation of poverty. a recognition of the fact that, hey, this ain't how it ought to be. This isn't how everyone lives. And one of those factors, of course, is the onset of communication media. People in some small village somebody in the village may get a little TV set that they plug in on their front porch, and people come around at night and watch it, and they see Jordache jeans and as ads on the U.S. Sitcoms that are dubbed into Spanish, and they see people driving around in fancy cars, and they see how the world lives, and they say, why are my kids dying of hunger? You know, why have I lost 3 children already? But even more than that, I think, has been the presence and the work of outside agents, that is, Peace Corps workers, church humanitarian aid workers, and other organizations and groups that have come into these regions, some of the poorest areas of Central America. Someone mentioned the Peace Corps. Peace Corps was very involved in Central America in those times, and begin to help people out of real tremendous motivation, I think, to improve their own situation for the better. And so what happened is that people's expectations were raised. They began to see that working together, maybe they could improve their situation. And so there was a period of hope and expectation that things could be better. But what happened is, what in all too many cases, was that those expectations were crushed when the ruling oligarchies of these countries refused to allow even moderate reform proposals to take place. In Guatemala is the most best example, but in Nicaragua under Somoza, and in El Salvador under the military governments that ruled El Salvador for so long, in Honduras as well, even modest attempts at reform were met with repression. I want to give you one example, a personal example that I had contact with and who involved people that I know that illustrates this. In the late 70s, 79-80, I had the opportunity to visit the work of World Neighbors in Guatemala. And World Neighbors is a very conservative development organization. It's based really in the fundamentalist churches in the South. Its headquarters is in Oklahoma City. I don't want to create stereotypes, but nevertheless, there they are. It's been a very conservative organization that is in Guatemala doing what I think was very, very interesting and exciting development work. What had happened is, and you need a little geography of Guatemala to understand this, Guatemala has the central highlands that run through the center of the country. It's part of the whole chain that runs down through the Americas. And it's then at the coast, there are broad coastal plains. And on these broad coastal plains are the large beef plantations, sugar plantations, and cotton plantations owned by the wealthy landowners of Guatemala. And the indigenous people, Indian people, that make up about 60% of the Guatemalan population, have been pushed into onto the mountainous slopes in tiny, tiny plots of land. That's all that's left for them. And so you see in Guatemala people growing corn on almost, 60% slopes. And I've seen that time and time again, where these most incredible slopes, I don't know that I could even walk up it. And there's corn growing on the hillside. Well, and then the other fact of this, of course, is that on those tiny plots, a farmer may not have more than a half an acre of land, so they can't possibly make it through the year on what they raise in that plot of land. And so what happens is that they're forced, during the harvest season, to go down to the coastal plain and work for $1 or $2 a day, picking cotton, harvesting sugarcane or whatever, in order to make it through the year with their family. So it was in this situation that World Neighbors came into Guatemala and said, well, what can we do? And one of the things they decided might be helpful is to work in the area of soil conservation. Because here you are with these slopes, right? And you plant the seeds and it all runs, the first rain comes and half the seeds wash down into the valley. And plus there's no topsoil left on those hillsides. And so what they did is using very, effective methods and very respectful of that region, they used some of the natural elements of the region to do soil conservation. They used some of the natural grasses and would plant on the contour a row of this grass that would grow very tall, and as the soil would wash down, it would build up behind the grass, Or if the, in certain areas, if there were a lot of rocks, they'd do it with rocks. And so what happened is a natural system of terracing that emerged, and without bringing in bulldozers or anything else. And I saw one situation that had been cultivated in this way that had built up a meter's depth of topsoil, of black topsoil. Very, very effective. What happened was farmers began to see that they had a chance to improve their lot. They began to work together and form cooperatives, because then they realized, well, if we buy seed together, we can get it cheaper, we can do all sorts of things. And gradually, they also began to start thinking about, well, what's causing some of our problems here, and analyzing the situation a bit. Well, in about 1981 or 82, I can't remember exactly, World Neighbors finally had to leave Guatemala. They were being accused of being communist and involvement in communist activity. Now, remember how I described World Neighbors. Now, why were they communist, do you think? What was happening was that these farmers that were improving their situation, it was really in one area, one primary area in central Guatemala, were improving their situation so much that they didn't have to go down to the coast to pick cotton and sugarcane. And so what was happening is a labor shortage on the coast, and there began to be strikes for higher wages, and this was disrupting the economic base of the coastal plain. And so anybody who was stirring up this problem was seen as the enemy, because these landowners were the generals and the wealthy men who ran Guatemala. And so it was during that time, the 70s and 80 and 81, when a tremendous repression began against any groups who were working in this kind of way. And in fact, the village that in which World Neighbors was working, was at one point surrounded by the Guatemalan military, and a huge massacre took place as a lesson to other villages not to be involved in this kind of activity. So you see what happened when this kind of reform took place was a tremendous repression that was put against the people. Perhaps the most important contributor to the waking of the poor in this process has been the grassroots pastoral work of the Catholic Church. If you were here last week, you heard Michael talk some about liberation theology, and I may do some more on that next week. The Catholic Church was very much involved in the formation of base Christian communities, small groups of Christians, where people received a new sense of being created in God's image, and therefore people with rights. Communities in which they're basically Bible study groups, right? But Bible study groups that in which people start from their own lives, their situation of being poor people, in which they began to reflect on their situation and read the Bible from the perspective of that situation. This new activity of the church emerged both as a result of the Second Vatican Council, in which people, the laity, was given a new role in the church, in the Catholic Church, and as a result of a very important Latin American bishops' conference that took place in Medellin, Colombia in 1968. And it was at Medellin that the vision of the church as the defender of the poor rather than the status quo was really given new impetus within the church. The people who were leaders of these base Christian communities often became involved in working in political groups as well, as they began to see their responsibility as Christians, that they needed to work for political change. And when the normal channels of political change didn't work, they began to even work more in some cases to take up arms to overthrow the governments in which they were involved. And this happened particularly in Nicaragua, and is happening today in El Salvador. It's these grassroots Christian groups, many of them, that later evolved into peasant organizations and labor organizations that became the foundation of the armed struggle in Nicaragua, and are the foundation of those armed struggles today in El Salvador and Guatemala. And the church also became involved in documentation of human rights abuses, of course. Now, what's relevant for today's situation, that's a lot of history in a few words, but is that many of those in the opposition today in El Salvador and Guatemala, and those who oppose Somoza in Nicaragua, did so out of strong religious motives. Their framework for understanding reality was the Bible, not Marxist concepts. And even those that did embrace some elements of Marx in terms of their understanding of a class struggle, for example, as one of the dynamics of society, did not take the whole package, because their source of motivation and strength came out of their Christian faith. And I think one of the serious miscalculations of U.S. policymakers is to underestimate the religious factor in the struggles in Central America today. So those were a couple, at least three of the dynamics, or however many I talked about there, this desperate poverty of the people of Central America, the awakening of the poor to their situation of the poverty through the work of outside humanitarian aid workers and through the work of the church, and then the tremendous repression that came when the poor begin to wake up and begin to try to even make small changes, that even those smallest changes are not tolerated. And those movements are crushed. And so what happened is an even stronger unification of the people. And we saw in 1979 in Nicaragua the overthrow of one of the cruelest dictators the world has seen, Anastasio Somoza, by the people, basically, of Nicaragua, led by a group called the Sandinistas. And what you see today in El Salvador and Guatemala is much that same process at work. People who are tired of being in a situation of oppression, of deep and desperate poverty, and who have, many, not all, have turned to arms because they see no other alternative. Now, to try to say, where does that leave us today then, in each of the countries of the region? What's the situation today in each of the five countries? I'm not including Belize, which is a different, there are many same issues, but it's not central, and I'm not going to try to deal with it, nor am I going to deal with Panama, which has a whole other set of issues today with Noriega. We're not going to deal with that. But let me just try to briefly reflect on each country as quickly as I can, because I want to give some time for discussion. In El Salvador, we have a civil war that's raging, putting insurgents against a military-dominated government that's backed by the United States. That is, the military government is backed by the United States. Neither side has a decisive advantage in the war, despite 8 years of war and about $3 billion in U.S. aid during that time, of course, to one side in far conflict. In addition to the land distribution, the problem in El Salvador that I described earlier, inequality of land, the military has a long history of violent repression. They allowed some political activity in the 60s, but prevented an opposition group from taking power after a duly elected election process in 1972. And since then, a broad opposition movement of peasants, students, workers, religious groups has grown up seeking economic and political reform. In 1979, the military began a sweeping campaign of assassination and repression, death squads and military operations that killed more than 50,000 civilian people from that time until today, although in recent years it hasn't been as strong. And as a result, many opposition activists joined the armed resistance movement. More and more people were pushed into it. The real power in El Salvador today is still the armed forces, though a president and an assembly were elected in recent years at Washington's urging, basically. The Duarte government, Napoleon Duarte has been the president, has been unable to negotiate with the guerrillas, carry out land reform, or prosecute army officers charged with human rights violations. It simply hasn't happened. And in March, to the surprise of virtually everyone, the right-wing Arena Party, which is the party of Daubison, who's usually credited with the killing of Archbishop Romero, his party stunned all by sweeping the National Assembly elections. Most interpret that election as a rejection of the ineffectiveness and the corruption of the Duarte government, with over half the country refusing to vote in a situation in which it's against the law not to vote. So the Arena victory raises a specter of the return to the levels of violence that we saw in the early 80s, with an increase in death squad activity already occurring. That has happened already. There's a real increase in death squad activity and more repression against church and human rights kinds of groups. In Nicaragua, Nicaragua was led by the Sandinista Front and overthrew a U.S.-backed dictator, Anastasio Somoza, in 1979. The U.S. deserted Somoza in the last six weeks to 2.5 months is when we finally completely said Somoza's got to go. But it's very interesting that Israel supported Somoza to the very, very end of his government. The new government was put in place after Somoza instituted land reform, extended health and education services, and developed a mixed economy with a public, private, and cooperative sectors. And the economy of Nicaragua grew substantially between 1979 and 1983. It was really quite remarkable to visit Nicaragua during that time and see the tremendous growth that was taking place in the economy and the burgeoning of development projects and so forth. Since the Contra War began in about 82, the economy has deteriorated badly. The Reagan administration has financed and organized a counter-revolutionary army based in Honduras and Costa Rica. Thousands of civilians, I think it's estimated that about 15,000 Nicaraguans and about two-thirds of those civilians have been killed. Agricultural co-ops have been destroyed, health clinics, schools, and development projects. As the war intensified, the Nicaragua government has suspended certain political rights and imposed press censorship. That was lifted in the beginning of the Arias plan, and last week, the La Prensa was temporarily closed again for 2 weeks, and the Catholic radio was closed for a time. It's certainly clear that Nicaragua also committed some human rights violations, especially on the Atlantic coast among the Miskito people during period from 81 to 84. And yet Amnesty International in their reports certainly criticizes Nicaragua for its human rights violations, but places them far ahead of most of the other countries in the region in that area. The tensions between the government and the internal opponents and the hierarchy of the Catholic Church have intensified during the war. Elections in 1984 produced a strong majority for the Sandinistas, and a constitution has been drafted and adopted after that election. Nicaragua adopted a non-aligned foreign policy in its early days of the government, but the war has forced it to turn to the Soviets for arms, and it's very strongly dependent on the Soviet Union today for arms. And Nicaragua has offered, however, to sign a regional peace treaty which would ban any foreign military involvement in Central America, including the Soviets and the Cubans, including the United States. As part of the Arias plan, the Sandinistas have signed a ceasefire with the Contras in an effort to reduce the conflict, but the U.S. administration appears committed to undermining that peace process at almost all costs. In Guatemala, since 1954, when the U.S. overthrew a democracy... Yes?
Would you say something about why the U.S. is choosing that policy?
I mean, that's my closing remark, so that's all right. I'll defer, because it'd be better in the context of the whole thing. When the U.S. overthrew the government of Guatemala, since that time, in 1954, it has had a violently repressive military government, confronting a guerrilla insurgency that began building at the same time. The majority, as I said, of the Guatemalans are Indians. During the early 80s, the armed forces carried out an anti-guerrilla campaign that killed, as I said, over 50,000 civilians. U.S. military aid to Guatemala was cut off during the worst of the repression, during the Carter administration, though aid still, in this case, flowed in from Israel also. The Reagan administration has restored aid to Guatemala. In 1984 and 85, the military permitted elections, seeking to improve the country's image, really, and partly to regain some of this foreign aid. Now it has a civilian president, his name is Cerezo, and a national assembly, but it's clear that the military still holds the balance of power. There are widespread human rights violations that continue, especially in the countryside, and those also seem to be on the increase. Again, now bodies are appearing on the sides of the road, even in Guatemala City, and it's becoming very repressive again. Honduras has the worst poverty in Central America. It's second only to Haiti in the hemisphere. It's historically less repressive, and the political violence has been less than its neighbors. It's been chosen, however, by the Reagan administration as the center for U.S. military operations in Central America. And I think you can see why, in terms of its strategic location. And it's a major base for the U.S.-backed Contras in their attack against Nicaragua. It's a base for reconnaissance patrols, aircraft patrols over El Salvador. There are about 1,500 U.S. troops in Honduras at all times, and tens of thousands have been brought in every year for exercises. It has basically a military government with a civilian face. Human rights violations have increased in recent years. The victims are leaders of emerging opposition movement, which wants economic reform and oppose the presence of the Contra and U.S. troops in Honduras. There's a very strong movement in Honduras opposing that presence, and it's those people who have been the victims of much of the abuse of recent months. And in recent months, there's been even a sharper increase in death squad killings and torture at a level that's unprecedented in Honduras. It's never happened before. Finally, in Costa Rica, we have a bit of an exception, a country with a long tradition of democratic politics, social reform, and a constitution that forbids an army. U.S. policy, however, has jeopardized the neutrality in Honduras, in Costa Rica, and spurred the buildup of a 10,000-member security force, a police force that looks awfully similar to an army, increasingly. Costa Rica is in an economic crisis and has externally imposed austerity measures by the International Monetary Fund, and that has undermined the country's very strong social welfare program. The Reagan administration has really sought to use Costa Rica's territory to create a southern front in the war against the Contras, and it uses economic leverage against Costa Rica in order to force them into that position. War has hurt Costa Rica by slowing regional trade, among other things, and it also has meant that there are many refugees in Costa Rica that need to be sustained. Costa Rica has played a very important role in regional peace initiatives, but really has come under heavy U.S. pressure for trying to stake out an independent foreign policy. USA to Costa Rica was held up basically because of Arias' involvement in the peace plan. And finally, the peace plan is another dynamic in the region. I think the Reagan administration was caught off guard when the five Central American presidents signed the plan. At the last minute, the administration tried to submit their own plan, and the presidents ignored it and signed their own plan. And so they were caught off guard, and while giving lip service to the plan, I think it's clear now that the administration is trying to undermine it. Now the question is why, right? Why? It's clear what our policy is in Central America. Our goal is to overthrow the government of Nicaragua in any way we can, and to make sure that no government any way resembling that appears in El Salvador and Guatemala. Now, what's the reason for U.S. policy in the region? Many like to say, and I think it's right to say that certainly it's an important dimension in U.S. foreign policy, that the reasons are economic, that we want to preserve our economic interests in the region. Now, I don't want to undermine that reason. It's a very important reason for U.S. foreign policy, but I think in the case of Central America, it is not the primary reason for our policy. If Central America were gone as a market for our exports and a source of our imports, it's only about, I think, 1.5% of our foreign trade. It's not that significant. There are not a lot of minerals for us, except oil and nickel reserves in Guatemala, some. So I don't think economic interests are the primary reason. To the extent that they are, economic interests are there, though the Nicaraguan experiment, I think, is seen as the threat to the interests that we do have in the region. Now, how is that so? The Nicaraguan revolution is seen as a beacon and a sign of hope to liberation struggles throughout the world, not just in Latin America, but throughout the world. And no matter what we think of it, if we think they're a bunch of Marxist goons, or if we think they're God's answer to the world, they are seen as a beacon of and a sign of hope to many liberation struggles. This is the real threat, I think, and the single most important fact for U.S. concern about Nicaragua. If the struggles in El Salvador and Guatemala and eventually in Honduras are successful, then not only the economic stranglehold, but the political and military control that the United States has had on Central America, and that's very clear historically, we have controlled that region. That control would be broken because we can't control Nicaragua anymore. Furthermore, the United States seems to accept one of two possible outcomes in Nicaragua. Our first choice would be to get rid of the Sandinistas. Throw the bums out and put a government in power that we could control. We'd like that to be civilian in nature, but if not, I think we would prefer a right-wing military government to the Sandinistas, if who we support in the rest of Latin America is any indication. The bottom line is a government that we can control. But if that fails, if we can't get rid of the Sandinistas, and increasingly it seems to be difficult to do so, then an alternative strategy, and I would suggest perhaps the more important strategy, or the one that's really being counted on, is to push the Sandinistas to become as dependent on the Soviet Union as they can become, to push them to be tightened up internally as much as possible. In other words, to create a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy so that we can say, look what's happened. Look what happens when any country tries any form of socialism. They inevitably become just like the Soviet Union. That's essentially what we've done with Cuba. We've written Cuba off and discounted it because it's become like the Soviet Union. And so the irony is here is that what we're doing is pushing Nicaragua to become everything that we're accusing it of becoming and criticizing it for becoming. Now you might say, well, now that sounds just a bit cynical. I mean, a little bit cynical view of U.S. foreign policy. But just basically, I've heard this very thing stated by State Department officials many times over the last few years. One example, several years ago, we were with the second in charge of the U.S. Embassy in Nicaragua, and somebody asked him this question. He said, isn't our policy pushing Nicaragua to become more dependent on the Soviet Union? Doesn't it cause it to tighten up internally? And he said, well, yes, I think you're probably right, but we've known that all. That's the way they were headed all along. We're just pushing them to speed up the process. So that it was this, you know, to bring this to fruition so we could really have the justification for coming down hard on them. And our goal then, I think, in doing that is to diminish their symbolic role to the rest of the world. Nicaragua is really attempting a sort of a third way, an alternative model between sort of the Eastern Bloc model and Western sort of free enterprise capitalism. And if that would work, real independence, that could be a real threat to the kind of economic and political control we've had in the region. I think it's increasingly clear, and I'll end with this point, that foreign policy under the Reagan administration, and I don't want to just blame the Reagan administration for our Central America policy. It's a long history of policy, of bad policy. But the ideology of national security has been so paramount with the Reagan administration that it sees all reality in such dualistic terms that any international conflict is seen as a manifestation of the struggle against international communism, and especially against the Soviet Union. So that our Central America is really seen the Central America conflict is seen as a manifestation of that struggle. So from this point of view, a country like Nicaragua that opts for a more socialist form of government, and there's no question that what Nicaragua wants is a more socialist form of government, and chooses an independent course of development, or a government like El Salvador, which is really striving for the same thing, and that is a revolutionary movement in El Salvador, can only be seen as serving Soviet interests. If you're operating in this mentality, it's sort of there's the good guys and the bad guys, and we're the good guys, and you're on one side or the other. If you're operating out of that mentality, then you see a country like Nicaragua that tries something unique, that challenges certain U.S. assumptions and principles, can only be seen as serving the Soviet Union. There's no other option. There is no room in the worldview because it would question the basic assumptions upon which our foreign policy is based. And so I think what we have in Central America today, and what's frightening to me is my presentation tonight is sounding frighteningly like the presentation I gave 5 years ago at Holden Village, and that I've been giving for a number of years. The situation hasn't changed very dramatically. The Arias peace plan is a very new thing, however, on the horizon. And what's happened, however, in the months since then, and the lack of support of the U.S. government to that plan, is perhaps one of the most discouraging things that's happened in the whole Central America arena. One last comment, I think, is that even in terms of what's happened in the last week or so, if the United States Congress in any way, shape, or form resumes military aid to the Contra, the Arias plan is finished. It's done. It has no hope of surviving that kind of attack, really, on the plan. Okay, let me stop. I keep going longer than I should, but
this high-ranking person from the Nicaraguan government that came to the U.S. recently.
Defected.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Military person.
I have to say, it fits into what you're saying then in terms of the forcing of Nicaragua to go that way, and then his view is answered, if I understand what you're saying, by his review of their policy being forced into that mold.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's a vicious circle. I don't like how the Sandinistas are heading in terms of some of their alliances with the Soviet Union. But I also saw what it was like initially. I mean, with the relationships with many Western European countries, which they still do. One of the strongest supporters of Nicaragua today, by the way, folks, are the Scandinavian countries, Norway and Sweden. And continue to be strong supporters in terms of development aid and that sort of thing. But initially there was military aid from France and so forth, but the U.S. used its bargaining chips with France to cut that off.
If you think Dukakis were elected, do you think there'd be much change?
Well, I'm hopeful about that, although his vice presidential selection didn't enhance that hope.
What are vice presidents the day after the election, though?
Yeah, well, I hope that's correct. The problem is there are... I think basically I'm hopeful. I mean, in his campaign TV ads during the primaries had an ad that specifically was addressed to the end of Contra aid. So I hope there... I don't see how there cannot be some kind of change with a change in administration.
Will Allied Abrams be out of the State Department?
Yes, certainly.
That can't help but be an improvement.
No. If there's a Democratic administration, Abrams will be gone. Yeah, Jerry.
I spent... not long ago, a week in Havana, meeting with some of the top leadership there, and
doing research, I hope.
I think that if some of those folks were here in the audience, they would like to take a little bit more credit for some of the positive things that have happened in Central America than your remarks suggested. In fact, I think I only heard Cuba mentioned it once or twice.
Yeah.
Could you comment on why you have kind of downplayed the Cuban influence?
Part of it, I haven't spent much time on Nicaragua. And I think there's a tremendous amount of Cuban influence in the, certainly in the military aid that's happened recently, and also in in the whole process of education and healthcare and that sort of thing that has happened in Nicaragua since the revolution. There's been tremendous amount of involvement in that. I think their influence, frankly, in El Salvador is much less in terms of their involvement with the guerrilla movement in El Salvador. I think the Cubans' involvement in that is much, much less than it has been in Nicaragua. I don't know so much about Guatemala. I think what has been the strongest, for example, the strongest, I think, input in Nicaragua has been in teachers. In recent years, it has been more military as well. But there were many, many Cuban teachers in Nicaragua during the first years of the government, working in some of the remotest areas. It's very interesting. Nicaragua sent out a call to teachers to any country that would send them, including the United States. And many countries responded, including Cuba. Cuba responded with the most. The U.S., of course, did not respond. Now, I think it's very important also with respect to Cuba, to the extent that Cuba is also, among other things, very much a model for much of Latin America. Well, again, whatever we want to think about Cuba, they're really seen as a model. I would suggest, I've been to Cuba also a couple of times, I would suggest that what I see happening in Nicaragua is much different than what I saw in Cuba, in terms of the kind of society that was being developed and formed. And today, even today, it's being formed.
Is that what you're hinting at, too, that it was? Or?
I haven't been in Nicaragua.
No, I mean Cuba.
So,
no, I think you're...
I think you're giving a...
Yeah, I think it was simply, it's right, there's right. There's a lot of Cuban involvement in many, many kinds of ways in the region, especially Nicaragua. They're obviously very close friends. But that's something different than to say that the Nicaraguan Revolution is something that was created in Cuba and exported to, yeah.
Steve, just comment, how was it that Costa Rica avoided this repressive oligarchy that's been the paradigm for all these other countries?
You know, I'm not really sure about that. The constitution that forbids the army was created in the late 1940s. I think a very progressive president at that time that really created that that situation. It's a country that has historically not had as not a poor. There's not been as many poor people in Costa Rica. They've had a better. Better economic structure overall. They've had a very sound educational program. But I can't really answer that question for you. I'm not sure historically why that's the case.
The tenure system in Costa Rica is more open to private ownership of land and significant plots of land.
Right, right.
And Joe, one of the frustrating things about listening to you talk about these various portions of the country and of the world mm-hmm. has been reflecting back on the leadership in our Lutheran church, in terms of Oregon, for instance.
Uh-huh.
I see the pastors and even the new bishop as being quite ecumenical, liberal, quite interested in all this.
Yeah.
And the vast majority of the people are much more like Mies and mm-hmm. Rehnquist and who are the Lutherans.
Yeah.
I don't think the people are anywhere where you're at.
Yeah, tell me about it.
I mean, it's scary.
It's very, you know, on one level, I think you're certainly true in the Lutheran Church, it's very difficult. On the other, there's another level, though, if you look at it nationally, for example, with respect to contrade, time and time again, U.S. population, the majority of the people are opposed to contrade. I don't know that I like those polls taken in the Lutheran Church. However, our conventions consistently have voted against it, you know, so it's a, but it is a real difficult problem, and I've had a number of conversations, even here again, with clergy especially, who are just struggling with how to infuse some of these ideas into people. You know, one of our principles at the center has been to while we try to take do tours and involve policymakers and that sort of thing, the bulk of our work is done with grassroots people. That it's at the grassroots where that kind of change is eventually going to happen. But that is such a long, slow process, you know. The good part of that is you don't need a majority to make change. You need a critical mass of committed people. And I think that's maybe what we have to think more in terms of.
Have you thought about a way to help those people learn the community organization around those kind of issues?
Well. Yeah, one of the things we're finding ourselves having to do, and I don't think we've done this as well as we have in the past, is to really translate some of those experiences that people have there back to our own reality. You know, and we just did a travel seminar to Detroit that was hosted by a group of inner-city Detroit residents who went to Central America. And then they said, we want people to see that same reality here, and it was a marvelous experience. And I think it's that need to begin for us to do analysis of our own society and the way we're trying to do is also a very important dimension. Because I think we need to be I guess all we're saying is here, we need to help people think critically about our own role in the world. And that's different than saying simply criticize. I think if you've been to my three lectures, you could probably say, can he ever say anything good about the U.S.? That's not the point. The point is that we as responsible citizens, I think, need to be able to think critically about our own country. That is one of the good things that I can say what I've said here tonight. I appreciate that tremendously, and I want that to be able to hang on to that. I see even that freedom for us in jeopardy. And Saturday I'm going to talk a little bit about that. This whole business of low-intensity conflict that I've been alluding to through all of these sessions, I think, calls into question the very democratic principles upon which our country is based. And that, to me, is the most frightening thing that I see on the horizon. I mean, I think what's happening in Central America is frightening and a tragedy. But finally, I think we have to make the argument in terms of what's happening to our own country.
Well, in that context, somebody told me that last year that there were bills introduced into Congress that would have made a person who participated in any way in Nicaragua, a religious leader or whatever, a terrorist.
Right. Came very close to that. That's correct. And it happened as a result of the. Some of you remember the death of Ben Linder, a U.S. citizen who was working on a hydroelectric project, was killed by the Contra. And so, what's the response of the U.S. government? Many in the government to say, well, those people who are working there are terrorists. We should define them as such and say we're not going to protect them. Now, that law didn't pass, but there was strong sentiment for it. See, and that's, you know, there's always been strong possibilities of restricting travel to Nicaragua because they don't like people going there, to kind of see the reality for themselves.